Welcome to the Red Rain Podcast. Here is your host from Revenge of the Birds, Walter Mitchell.
Thank you, Kyle Little Rock Ledbetter. Today we bring back Marcos Labrada from AZ Underground, who has been doing some really fabulous film work, most recently of Kyler Murray. So I want to turn it over to Marcos and ask him, what are you discovering on film about Kyler Murray?
Well, I gave you like my little, not synopsis or like my, I'm not sure what to really call it, but it's basically like my overall assessment of Kyler Murray. And that was pretty descriptive. But right, the one thing that I do want to pull away, because this is the one thing I do want to cover to make sure that, you know, people know that this is something that hasn't actually been, when it comes to Kyler Murray, it hasn't really been improved on. It's just something that I don't believe can be improved on. But his footwork always sticks out on, like, a sore thumb on film. And the reason why it's basically his footwork sticks out on film is because it has to do more about his vision and his size. So you put out an article, what was it, like about 3 or 4 months ago, that was also brought up at Pickering Mirage. So they discussed it, and it was mostly going over what Brock Purdy does when it comes to footwork. We're talking about maneuver in the pocket. He doesn't, like, right, scramble from the pocket. He just looks for, like, an open, like, passing lane. He's just looking for that wide, right, open passing lane so he could be able to deliver the ball. The way, right, he does that is he floats back and forth. He tries, right, to feel the pressure around there. He duck dodges, weaves, duck and dodges, and ducks. And he does that basically to be able to buy himself a little bit more time in the pocket to deliver, right, a throw. That hasn't been something that Kyler Murray has been able to do in his career. And I'm not sure if he can do that as he goes, because I've noticed the way he releases the ball, he stands more tall in the pocket. I know that's kind of weird to say about a quarterback that's 5'9", 5'10". But the reason why that's the case is because when he has to release the ball, he has to release it at his highest trajectory in order for him to be able to throw it over the defensive tackles that are trying to actively block his football from, right, you know, obviously even leaving the pocket. So as he does that, he has to hide himself a little bit higher, which has given him that taller stance. And if we all know anything about having like a wide, like a shorter, like basically your legs are, you know, short distance from each other, not wide, there's nothing you can do about like being able to like shuffle back and forth so that you can, you know, maneuver in the pocket. He just has to make his decision and he has to throw that ball. So being that as it is, his footwork can be kind of like he can be jittery. And because he doesn't have the other option of being able to like weave around the pocket or buy himself a little bit more time, like we've seen other quarterbacks do, he has to make his decision whether he wants to stay in the pocket and deliver that throw or just leave the pocket altogether, just take off.
Right. Yeah. You know, I used to do drills with that when I was coaching, and I had like linemen putting up brooms and we did drills on it, you know, sort of like a picket fence drill, we called it. And the quarterbacks would, you know, we'd send 3 or 4 rushers and then guys at the line with brooms, who would, they're not stationary. They'd try to, you know, move along with the quarterback. So the quarterback could put the pressure on him to first feel the rush and second be able to float to where he could create clear passing lanes and buy that extra second of time that you're talking about. So it's a skill that I believe can be developed in time with the proper reps. But I also get where you're coming from. You know, this is Kyler's, what, 6th season now in the NFL. And, you know, it's just, I don't know. I kind of agree with you in a way. I just don't know if this is a learnable skill for him at this point in his career. So what you do about that is with Drew Petzing and Kyle Ledbetter, my Little Rock He helped me become a little more enlightened in what Drew Petzing was trying to do with Kyler. You know, it was only a few times a game. I mean, it's not like he's under center a lot. And under on play action, he did move Kyler around a little more than Cliff did, but not significantly more. And I think that in due time, they're probably going to have to move Kyler more. Even out of shotgun snaps, go on, you know, like short sprints right or short sprint left or short waggle right, short waggle left. And to get Kyler off of just this singular launching point that he typically likes to throw from. Because we've seen when Kyler is on the move, he can make really good plays. And I'm still waiting for like the plays that he used to do scrambling front at Oklahoma where they were home run passes. Haven't seen too much of that with him as a pro yet. But he's got the arm to do it, and when he gets out in space, he's got the vision. So getting Kyler in space is obviously a really good move. The other thing I'd like to see is the Cardinals do more of, chipping down on the edges as they rush, so to seal the corner if Kyler goes wide. I think that can aid and abet the amount of time that Kyler can have out in space. And I think any time that Kyler's in space, it puts the defense at a distinct disadvantage. But, yes, I think you've come probably to the correct conclusion, but the ways to kind of ameliorate that or improve that is what they can do creatively out of their play action.
Yeah, you're absolutely right when it comes to getting them in space. And you're absolutely right about the fact that, like, under Cliff Kingsbury, they really didn't do much. And my hinge about that was that in that situation, I get kind of angry with Cliff Kingsbury. You already know, like, I defend him as much as I can. But there was no excuse for not trying to force the issue when it comes to putting him under center, because he did have plays that did operate from under center. And yeah. He did showcase those when another quarterback would come in, naturally speaking. So in that sense, I think to myself, well, why didn't he do this more often with Kyler Murray? Even if it was the case that Kyler Murray wasn't a fan about doing this, you have to force the issue to be able to say, look, I tried to get him under center. Kyler Murray just isn't comfortable from under center. So in that situation, like, it kind of angers me knowing that, like, now with Drew Petzing, like, Kyler Murray didn't start from under center at the beginning, but then he started kind of, you know, gravitating towards it, towards where there were some games where you saw, like, the first two series was just him being under center, either handing the ball off, like I thought Cliff Kingsbury could have done very, very often, or, you know, just doing it from a bootleg situation where he's just pretty much looking for two targets in general. That was Greg Dortch and Trey McBride. So it's a shame those two players were still on the team when Cliff Kingsbury was the head coach. In that little, you know, situation where they were butting heads and whose fault it was in that 2022 season, he could have really cleared his hands by being able to, like, try to force the issue. But instead, he decided to just, you know, allow Kyler Murray to just be comfortable in the pocket and see if that can go ahead and, you know, go towards another 2020 or 2021 season where Kyler Murray was a MVP candidate for half a year.
Yeah. The thing, though, is the mitigating factor there, you know, it's just mind-boggling to me is that this will be the first off-season, Marcos and Kyle, where Kyler Murray, assuming he's going to do it, will be on the field for OTAs. First time since his rookie year. So he missed 4 years in a row, two due to COVID, which weren't his fault. And And sadly, last year, because of having to rehab, you know, he couldn't get out on the field until October. And then, but the year that really burns and the year that led to his, you know, demise under Cliff, which I don't think Cliff could have done anything about, to tell you the truth. He skips OTAs. And then in training camp, he's not available there either because he first got COVID and then he was nursing an arm problem. So he wasn't getting any reps. And in today's, and I don't know how you change an offense or modify it or put in new wrinkles when your starting quarterback is unavailable. You know, the first week of practice that they had Kyler under center in the shotgun was week one preparation for Kansas City. I mean, that whole duration, you hadn't had him on the field. And you can't blame Cliff for that. I mean, Cliff was there the whole time. And what you can do is laud Cliff for what he did with his other quarterbacks who were there. I mean, Colt McCoy, 3-1 versus the NFC West. Are you kidding me? All three blowouts where he was in total command? I mean, fourth quarter leads with Trace McSorley over Tom Brady, with David Blau over Desmond Ridder. In the fourth quarter lead there, with Blau having just shown up in 2 weeks. So the offense, the problem wasn't Kingsbury, in my mind. The problem was Kyler and all the things that went with it. There's so many people to blame. You know, it was an anomaly. I mean, if you go down Cliff Kingsbury's track record, I don't know if anyone on the planet can boast this. Let me quickly go through it for you. 2010, these are where he was calling plays. Starting in college at the University of Houston, his quarterback was Case Keenum. 480.5 yards per game, 11th in the country out of 120. 2011, Case Keenum, 599.1, first out of 120. 2012, Johnny Manziel, Heisman Trophy winner, 558. 3 out of 124. 2013, Davis Webb and Baker Mayfield, 511, 8th out of 125. 2014, Davis Webb and Patrick Mahomes, 504.1, 10 out of 128. 2015, Patrick Mahomes, 579.5, 2nd out of 128. 2016, Patrick Mahomes, 566.2, 1 out of 128. 2017, Nick Semenek, 474.6, 16th out of 130. 2018, his last year at Texas Tech, when his best quarterback was having a great year and got knocked out in the Oklahoma game, Alan Bowman, and they turned it over to Jeff Duffy, 483 yards, 0.3, 12th out of 130. Then he comes to the NFL, inherits the absolute worst offense up and down the roster, except for Larry Fitzgerald, you know, and what else, you know. But in the first year, Kyler comes in, gets offensive rookie of the year to the tune of 341.7, which was 21st, up from 32nd in the NFL. And so in 2020, Kyler Murray, 384.6, sixth in the NFL out of 32 teams. 2021, Kyler Murray and Colt McCoy, 373.6, eighth in the NFL out of 32 teams. 2020, and here's the anomaly year, and yet still it's not awful, terrible. So Arizona quarterbacks, Kyler Murray, Colt McCoy, Trace McSorley, David Blau, 338.8, 22nd out of 32. What's the anomaly here? It's that year. of all of those years, you can, I think, getting from 32nd to 21st with Kyler as a rookie was a tremendous achievement. Don't you?
Yeah, I do think so. That, you know, after the year that they had with in 2018, and having that offensive coordinator get fired like midway through the season that year, I do think it's a great accomplishment. And we are talking about like a rookie Kyler Murray, which at the time, I mean, the sentiment now is with most Arizona Cardinals fans is they believe in Kyler Murray, but in that season in 2019, we're still trying to see what we had with Kyler Murray. So
right.
There was more like unbiased type of, you know, like
right.
takes or any type of like unbiased, like people didn't have rose tinted sunglasses when they were looking
right.
at Kyler Murray that year. They were just able to say, you know, like, hey, we still don't know what we have in him. So and to be real, I don't even think like Kyler Cliff knew what they had in this situation. They just did what they could to improve the offense and get him in situations like they did in Atlanta, where they went up as high as they did, and that offense was operating like phenomenally. And there were some games towards the end of the season where, I mean, we all hear the same thing about Cliff Kingsbury, that his team's falter in the second half of the year, yet we don't hear anything about the defenses like completely giving up leads in those second, and like in the second half of the season, that's when the defense starts faltering off. And
right,
you know how many times I've brought up the issue when it comes to our defense and our defensive coordinator, where this type of defense was built to be in a situation where you have to have a lead, a sizable lead in the fourth quarter in order to dominate, because of the type of scheme that Vance Joseph liked to employ. But he runs that same type of defense that is very risky to run when you're either up by like 3 or 7 points, or when you're down, because it wasn't going to be something that was going to functionally continue to work. He was a home run hitter in the fourth quarter that kept striking out. And that's not on Cliff on that situation. You could ask Cliff to tell the general manager to fire his defensive coordinator. You could tell,
right,
hey, Cliff, can you take over the reins of being defensive coordinator? It's like, that's not why we hired him for, but sure, let's go ahead and blame Cliff for that. I mean, one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard was people saying that Cliff shared the entire blame, and I kept mentioning the same thing. What about Vance? What blame does he have?
Right.
Is it just a biased perspective where you hate Cliff so much that Vance Joseph gets to fly under the radar as the best coach on our team? Give me a break.
Right. Yeah, it reminds me kind of and Kyle is such an NBA guru. I'm a Hawks fan, Atlanta Hawks. They've got every game, and when they're healthy, they've got like 9 guys capable of double figures, and 2 of them are capable of 30 plus every night. And they have a losing record in the NBA because they fill the nets. They have like the third, I think, highest offense per game, but their defense has been awful. It's been better lately. Good for them, because they're going to get into the playoff, the play-in. But it kind of reminds me of that with Cliff's. Like, when people play the Hawks, they know they got to outscore them. So they go, like, you know, they go into scoring mode. I think that when people play Cliff Kingsbury teams, that's the same mentality. Because it's a given he's going to put up numbers. You know, so you got to come in there going, like, well, we got to find a way to outscore them. And by and large, because of, you know, at Texas Tech, it was so hard for him to sustain a quality defense because he didn't have the depth. And, you know, later in the season when you've got injuries and stuff, you got to rely on your depth. And plus, that schedule got wicked hard down the stretch every year from the beginning, you know, when they have to play the heavyweights in the Big 12. It's just too bad that he never had a defense that could bail the offense out if it ever needed to be bailed out, and that he never really had that in Arizona. I mean, Vance's second year was probably his best. And dang, if, you know, so many things happened in that season that, you know, if, you know, maybe one or two plays happened here or there, That's a playoff team. We could have gotten it. We right down to the wire, and what bad luck for Kyler Murray to roll his ankle on like the third play of the game against the Rams. I mean, we win that game, we're in. And then, you know, we saw what happened. We had to go to Chris Streveler and against that defense. That was the great evener because the Rams weren't playing. They were playing John Wolford. But, I mean, and there were other games like getting whacked at home by the, like a 5-win 49er team, you know, where the 49ers played out of their minds, particularly on defense. And, you know, Jason Verrett shut down Hopkins in that game, and to the point where Hopkins got a 15-yard penalty trying to slug Verrett.
And to your point, Walter, real quick. So I went back to the DVOA numbers for the last four seasons. That's all the data that they had available.
Yeah, right.
So in 2020, the Cardinals had the 14th ranked DVOA defense in the league.
There you go. Yep.
2021, which was obviously the year that they went, you know, 9-2 to start or 9-1 to start the season, they finished with the 7th ranked DVOA defense.
They
and
did.
Then, yep, they were number 7 that year.
Oh, I'm surprised at that.
And then you jump to 2022 and they plummeted from 7th to 26th.
Right.
I got a lot to say about that DVOA when it comes to like that 2021 season. And I can tell you right off the bat, I don't think there's anybody more well-versed about that season when it comes to like the defense than I was, mostly because I was on a fire of Vance Joseph campaign. But there's an article that was written by a PFF writer. And it detailed what, you know, the scheme was that, like, Vance Joseph liked to employ. So, as you remember, Walter Mitchell, that year we had a lot of leads almost at the beginning of almost every game, with the exception of a few. And the one that they didn't have the lead on, where they got into a shootout, was that Vikings game that we almost lost.
Oh, yeah.
We won by missed field goal. But,
like
I kept mentioning, you know that, as well as I do, the Vance Joseph he's a very aggressive type of blitz-heavy defensive coordinator. So the way he can play, like have his defense play basically efficient, is to be able to get into a big enough lead where their quarterbacks have to draw back in the pocket more often to be able to catch up or to be able to keep up. So in that circumstance, what's gonna be the best option for a defensive coordinator to be able to like shut down games is to continuously blitz or try to get like, you know, some sort of a game breaking play off of being aggressive. You get more opportunities to do that when the opposite team doesn't have to run the ball. However, let's not forget that defense was horrible in 2021 when it comes to stopping the run. As a matter of fact, like I mentioned so many times before, that our Cardinals defense has been weak against the run for probably the last 5 or 6 years. But during the Vance Joseph years, that was definitely a bugaboo about the Cardinals. And the reason why is because he employed light boxes, a lot of too high sets. He did a lot of exotic type of blitzes where he'd line up like 5 or 6, linebackers at the line of scrimmage. And whether he pulled them into, you know, into zones or he actually had them commit to the blitz, you still have a light box that wasn't really built to be able to stop the run. And so he sacrificed stopping the run to get more athletic at every position there and to try to just get to the quarterback. But as we saw, there was a lot of circumstances where his blitz packages would either come short and would be picked apart, and he would not adjust to that. I mean, we saw that with the Seahawks game at the end of the season. The Seahawks had nothing to play for. We had everything to play for, and they completely folded.
Yeah. In fact, I mean, that's why I was surprised, Kyle, about the DVOA. And that probably was, you know, because of all the good defensive play when they had J.J. Watt.
Yes.
We're at their strength, because down the stretch, all right, in the last five games, if you win one of those, you win the NFC West.
Let's not stop at the last five games, because Marcos brought up a great point. So I went back and crunched the numbers real quick. So the early on in the season when they were blowing teams out early and teams were forced to throw more like that, it was putting the Cardinals defensively in a better position. In the first eight games, the Cardinals allowed 16.2 points per game. And then in the last eight games, that number goes from 16.2 to 14.2. I'm sorry, that's first eight, last eight. So first eight, 16.2, last eight, 24.2. And the line of demarcation is the Packers game, which, if you'll remember, was the game that Kyler Murray has the ankle injury and ends up missing 4 weeks after the fact. So it would appear that as soon as the offense lost their quarterback and lost kind of the momentum they had built up early in the season, that's when the defense starts allowing over a touchdown per game more. And so that appears to be kind of the line of demarcation in the season was the Packer game.
Right. And for Kyler Murray, the Packer game was a turning point in his career. You know, because he is not, in terms of quarterback efficiency, he hasn't been the same since. I mean, not even close. I mean, I just bought the Lindy's Draft magazine, and you know, I thought the guy who did the Cardinal preview for them this year was Howard Balzer, who was with Phoenix, and I think he's now with Jess Root at Cards Wire writing articles, although I haven't seen it much from him lately. I found it curious that here's what he said about Murray was, by the end of the 2023 season, Murray was playing with confidence and looked as good as the player that was the Offensive Rookie of the Year in 2019 and an MVP candidate during the first part of the 2020 and 2021 seasons. Boy, to me, that was quite a leap. I mean, Kyler played, don't get me wrong, maybe one of the best games of his career against the Eagles. No question about it. He was fantastic in the game. He played an efficient game in beating the Steelers in Pittsburgh with all those rain delays. You know, and the defense played its best game of the season, that Elijah Strong or Kevin Strong stuff of Najee Harris on the goal line was huge, and that game was a great win. But, you know, but if you look at Mike, the quarterback's rating that I look at the most heavily is QBR, right, Marcos? Because QBR, it factors in every aspect of quarterbacking. Whereas rating is more, you know, so, you know, in QBR, so with Kyler, for example, all right, so, you know, for Cliff, here's how his QBRs have gone in his career, right? So as a rookie, he was 57.7, which for a rookie is good. Then second year, he climbed into the 60s at 61.9, right? Oh, wait, yep. In third year was his best at 63.2. But then 2022 plummeted to the worst of his career, 53.6. And as I said, that had a lot to do with this tumultuous offseason, the whole offense not even being on the field and together until the week before the Kansas City game, you know, all the things I enumerated. And then last year was his worst QBR by far at 47.2. You know, I mean, to be honest, Kyler flashed. He showed us the Kyler who could be electric in that first game, and the scramble in the Atlanta game was awesome. And some of the scrambles he had later were awesome. But as we all predicted, you know, it was going to take time for Kyler not only to bounce back from his rehab, but to acclimate to a new offense. So you've got to give him some slack there. But, you know, is the bar so low now on Kyler Murray that you're already, you know, we got a national great writer like Howard Balzer saying like Kyler was his old self back in 2021, at the early part of 2021, when, you know, let's just go game by game. Atlanta's QBR was 56. Houston, that was not a good game for Kyler. 45. The Ram game, 37. The Pittsburgh game, even though we won, it wasn't a great, you know, performance quarterback-wise. It was a 52. But for us, you know, for that situation, it was under those circumstances, it was everything that we needed to do to win. So forget about the score. I mean, the score to look at was the best thing. But then the San Francisco 49er game, 21. The Bears game, 20. And then he bounces back with an 85 against the Eagles, and then back to a 53 against the Seahawks. So he only had one game over 60, and the one game he had over 60 was the brilliant game. So what it proved was, wow, you know, yeah, Kyler still has what it takes. But the question is, does he have the consistency? And the only consistent stretch he's really had of that, you know, like 7-8 game stretch was in the beginning of 21, where, by the way, virtually every game they're scoring 30-plus, except for one, which was that 49ers game at home that they eked out 17-10. You know, that was brilliant football. What, did Cliff just start to get stupid? I don't think so. That Green Bay game was a game changer. What do you guys think happened in that? Because something happened afterwards. Kyler was never quite the same, and he's still not in terms of consistency. What do you think happened?
I wanted to I'm not going to get off topic just a little bit. I wanted to explain to the listeners about what you mean about QBR and some of the things that are like important about like the difference between that and quarter and passer ratings. Yes. But one of the big indicators that QBR is a somewhat of a better like or a better measurement of a quarterback's performance is they do take a lot of different things into account. Like, for example, if a quarterback throws a pass and it's just say it's like a 7-yard completion, but the wide receiver takes it for like 70 yards for a touchdown. Well, as a passer rating, it will still be a positive rating for that throw. Whereas with the QBR rating, it would be taken into account that it was just a 7-yard completion and that, the rest of the work was done by the wide receiver. So it takes those type of like, it's just deeper and more accurate when it comes to measuring what a quarterback's performance is as opposed to a pass rating. So I just wanted the listeners to know, like, when you're using the QBR, it's because it's a better system per se. It's supposed to be like a refined system of a pass rating. So going over like that Green Bay game. So that Green Bay game was a shootout. And we both know that one of the things that isn't spoken about more often is like there was a little bit of a situation where the Cardinals kind of shot themselves in the foot. Whether you want to blame Kyler, you want to blame Rondale Moore, there was an interception thrown in our red zone that kind of hindered us. And I believe there was another mistake that hindered us early in the game, aside from, you know, the interception at the end of the game, which to this day, people still rail on AJ Green for not turning around, even if they didn't know what the play design was or whether they even knew what AJ Green was supposed to do on that play. They just go ahead and just blame AJ instead of, you know, giving any type of flack to Kyler Murray for, like, not being on the same page with this wide receiver who was in the league for like 9 years prior to that as a all pro receiver. So that I think that's kind of ridiculous that people are still hinging on that. But the defense also let us down as well. I mean, the defense couldn't stop the run. As we all know, Aaron Jones had his way with the defense. I mean, it's Aaron Rodgers is Aaron Rodgers, whether you like his personality or not. He's still like, even at that year, he still was seen as an elite type of quarterback. So for him to be able to get into a shootout with Kyler Murray, it was just a circumstance where the Cardinals had to win by being the last one to possess the ball. And kudos to the defense for at least getting that fourth down stop in the red zone, which gave us the opportunity to be able to come back and win that game. They did march down, but unfortunately, what ended up happening was the very last play where you had the choice to be able to close it out, there was a miscommunication on that, and it basically cost us the game. Once again, after everything was said and done, instead of, you know, saying, you know, hey, we could have done better, or just saying like, hey, we just had miscommunication, I hear Kyler Murray at the podium saying like, I don't know what the heck happened that last play. And people just started trashing on AJ Green, getting very upset, as if like AJ Green just did something like horrendous. Like, you remember all the flack he was getting and all the everything that was being said about AJ, and I talked to myself, that's not fair.
Right. That was such a critical moment. And my theory is, well, first of all, you know, Kyler audibled out of the last two plays, both very, very costly. Sorry about that. On the one that the first one he audibled out of, he kind of played hero ball and ran a sprint out for himself, like a speed option, where I don't think it was communicated well. And I thought he was one of those plays where he could like have he knew the line was going to block a certain way, so he just take it himself, like he did in that Tennessee game that started the winning streak in week one back in 21. You know, Kyler would do stuff like that where he'd call a play and then just take the ball himself. Because we saw on that play, it got blown up because a D-back came in on a blitz and then rolled Kyler's ankle. High ankle sprain. Ba-boom. Then Kliff calls the timeout. And this is key. Which he should have done. Perfect thing to do. You're already in field goal range, so you can tie this game up if you don't convert. But you're knocking on the door, right? So Kyler goes over to the sideline. And this is what often happens between a battle of egos between a quarterback and a play caller. And you know Kliff, I mean, if he's got a fault, he's just, you know, he's so amenable to a fault at times. Like, he'll dive on the sword for any player, you know. But Kliff had a play dialed up that he thought would win the game, as he had called in the play before that was audibled out of. So coming out of a timeout, you know, the team was set. And then Kyler calls an audible that A.J. Green doesn't pick up. And it's inexcusable. I mean, at this point in the season, you're 7-0. It's so inexcusable. So, you know, it's like perfect scapegoat is to blame A.J. Green. But obviously, A.J. Green knew this play to be a different play because he was blocking. So we don't even know what that play was. It could have been a draw play to James Connors or something. It could have been anything, but, you know, it's just unfortunate. But then after the game, you now have this conflict. And if I were Kliff Kingsbury getting, you know, audible two times in a row with a game like of that magnitude on the line and watching how those plays developed, I'd be bullshit. I mean, but Kliff is so, like I said, amenable, and he'll cover for Kyler. But I think behind closed doors, he and Kyler had a bit of a talking.
I would go in the other direction and say that they needed a talking and there was a breakdown in communication. And I think they kind of allowed that to fester as the 2022 season went along, because we know a lot of details about the fallout, and we've talked extensively about 22, but a big part of the fallout was like Cliff and Kyler just stopped communicating with each other at a certain point. Like they were just so upset and didn't sit down and want to work through it that they just had the quarterback coach as a mediator. And I think that was part of the problem, is that they probably didn't have that communication. Add in the fact that Kyler's now hurt and he's out for 4 weeks at that point. Add in, you know, we were doing podcasts together back in that 21 season. That was our first year doing Red Rain. And I just remember saying the whole time, man, it's just that team was built on six key players and four of them are injured. Like just all the important players on the team all got hurt within the span of about 4 weeks of each other. And it derailed the 21 season specifically, but they allowed those conflicts of the 21 season to kind of carry over into 22 as everyone starts fighting for money.
Yeah, well, let me modify that, because then Colt McCoy happened. Team didn't break down. I mean, they had the clunker at home against Carolina.
No, I meant the team physically broke down.
Yeah, but they didn't. I mean, the two wins, NFC West road wins with Colt McCoy were stunning. And that was the offense. See, that was where, you know, Colt McCoy, the disparity of watching Colt McCoy in those games versus Kyler at Green Bay was profound, because, you know, I mean, the Colt McCoy's was so on schedule. I mean, it was just so clean and smooth and with very little hiccups. And both games were, you know, salted away halfway into the fourth. I mean, it was just awesome. And if we don't win those two games, chances are we wouldn't get into the playoffs that year at all. I mean, so Colt, you know, maintained things, you know, kept the fort going. And then, you know, I think there was some sentiment, and I heard this through my sources, that some of the players on offense wanted Cliff to continue with Colt, because they felt like the offense was running smoother and there was more, you know, stability from the quarterback position, unless, you know, and so, I mean, already you're starting to have a bit of a, you know, conflict amongst the team about, because Colt played so well in those games. And, you know, I mean, there's something about Colt's presence and leadership. I mean, you saw HBO. Did you see it, Kyle? HBO in season?
I did not. I don't know if Marcos watched it.
Marcos, I watched it. Yeah, I watched most of it, and then I just kind of stopped watching it after a while. I'm not even going to lie to you guys. My subscription ran out, and I didn't feel like renewing it, because I was like, you know, I kind of seen enough of the, like, you know, pretty much the behind the scenes to be able to know and understand that, like, there's a lot, like, there was a bad cloud over that team. And the galvanizer, which unfortunately to a lot of people that don't believe the quarterback is a leader, he has to be the leader, especially if you pay him all that money. Because if you're paying him all that money, you're pretty much saying this is our franchise guy and he's untouchable. So, like, every standard has to be set on that guy, and he's actually supposed to be the one that's supposed to set the standards. So whether people believe it or not, you do have to have some modicum of some leadership to be able to, like, be the quarterback of a team. Because if you're down and your quarterback has bad body language, the rest of the team is just, especially the offense, they're just not going to believe they can operate, or they're not going to believe they're going to win. And if that's the type of a quarterback you have, who's leading their entire team, well, your offense is just going to fall by the wayside. Because then, you know, one play, this receiver might not block as much, or might not try to give as much effort when it comes to blocking. This tight end might not run his route as crisp and smooth, because he's like thinking to himself, what does it matter? Like, am I getting the ball or am I not? Because my quarterback's not, his head is not in the game. My quarterback's upset and he's showing bad body language. He's sitting at the edge of the bench and he's not over here yelling at us, telling us like, hey, we need to get up, we need to do this, we need to come back. Now, to Kyler's credit, I believe he's doing more of that this year. But it shouldn't take this much for us to demand, like, Kyler, you need to be a leader. these guys need to look up to you. You need to get on these guys, and you also need to hold yourself accountable. It shouldn't take this long. It shouldn't take a big contract and your coach that not only fell on the sword for you, but is the reason why you got drafted by the Cardinals to begin with. It shouldn't come to the point where it's like, hey, you fired the guy I wasn't getting along with, and you gave me the big contract. Now it's time for me to be a leader.
Yeah, and the Colt did it again in 22 when finally he got his chance. The disparity of watching Kyler hardly even being able to get a snap off without all those just hiccups and distractions, to suddenly seeing this smooth operation in LA against Aaron Donald and the Rams. Now, the Rams weren't having one of their better years. They were coming off of Super Bowl hangover and whatnot, but still the Rams. And that offense with only one starter left on the offensive line and Kelvin Beecham. I mean, the most shaped. In fact, Cole had to say to national TV afterwards, he goes, yeah, and we only had one starter from the original starting lineup on the offensive line. Those guys played great, unbelievable. And, but if you go back to HBO, and I don't know if you saw long enough to see inside what was happening inside the quarterback rooms, was that the disparity of leadership in those rooms, in the quarterback room, was just night and day. I mean, the adult in the room, and really the coach in the room, was Colt McCoy. I mean, his spirit, his intensity, his preparation. And then what you had was Trace McSorley eating breakfast, which I thought was just abominable. And then you had Kyler just slumped back in his chair, chill. I mean, the disparity of all that was just enormous.
So what in connection to the Packer game conversation that we were having earlier,
yes.
So as the year goes along, the disparity there kind of outlines the lack of quote unquote leadership in Kyler Murray's mind. But how does that, in your mind, lead to the fallout in 2022? Because it would appear they carried over some hard feelings from the end of 21 into 22. Add into the fact that there's, you know, money at play and holdouts and things of those sorts that are driving the conversation around the offseason.
Well, here's what I believe happened, and I don't have any proof of this. I've heard, let's just say it's an educated, sort of theory.
Before you say it, let's make that clear to the audience. This is not what happened. We do not know for sure. Okay,
go ahead. It could be what happened, but it's also shaped by things that I heard from the locker room through sources, a couple of sources, actually. And here's what I believe happened, was that when Kyler came back from his high ankle sprain, the number one focus wasn't winning. It was on him getting his bag. His overzealous agent, Eric Burkhart, who I said at that time, Kyle will back me up on this, I said the one person who could take the Cardinals down more than any other when they were 7-1 was Eric Burkhart. And everyone said, you're out of your freaking mind. I said, no. Because then, that was at the same time Burkhart went public with, oh, Oklahoma's going to hire Cliff Kingsbury. I mean, are you freaking kidding me? I mean, this agent was like the worst thing to ever happen to the Cardinals in that season.
Yeah, I remember how pissed you were about Cliff not coming out and denouncing it.
Right, and the big difference with Kyler in the early season and Kyler in the late season, Kyler had the yips. I mean, he was 1 second in the pocket and just like running around like crazy backwards. I mean, he was like running for his life. And I'm sure that Eric Burkhart said, Kyler, if you want your bag this year, you cannot get hurt again. You can't be stigmatized with being hurt all the time. So I think Kyler was saving. How many times in the stretch, when we're one game from winning the NFC West, and look what Marco alluded to, how we got whacked by Russell Wilson in the last home game with them having nothing to play for, and Pete Carroll waxing us, 38 points. Talk about Vance Joseph defense. How many times did you see Kyler just take a dive? I mean, he wasn't willing to scramble much anymore. I mean, and then when he was under pressure, he'd just take a dive. Wouldn't try to extend plays.
But wasn't the scrambling part also because the ankle was still hurt? Like, that was part of the conversation as well, was that he was playing through injury even if they took off the 4 weeks to recover the ankle.
Well, they gave him extra time. They right. didn't rush him back because of the fact that they were having that success with Colt McCoy. And let me point something out for everybody. Colt McCoy didn't have DeAndre Hopkins either during that three-game stretch, but they had three games and they had a bye week. So they gave him a month and they weren't trying to rush him back. They were they were making it a point to make sure that when Kyler Murray comes back, he's fully healed and that he's not rushing back to the field. But he did have a couple of designed runs even in those stretches. The Indianapolis Colts game, the one that comes to mind right away where he had that, I think it was like a 40-yard scramble over the middle, but he was more timid or he was more like careful with trying to scramble over the middle, which was something that, you know, like Kyler Murray didn't do much of that during his early years, but he was more willing. But towards this season and the end of the 2021 season, he was trying to hit the edge more often to try to, you know, run out to basically get as much yardage before he runs out of bounds and whatnot. But those over the middle scrambles, they just completely disappeared.
And that's one of the reasons why in that article that Dan Bickley and Vince Murata were talking about, my second point was how Kyler had to get back scrambling up the middle to keep pass rushers honest, which he did a little bit, on a couple occasions, big occasions down the stretch this year, which was really encouraging. And, you know, I think Kyler's in a much better place, and we'll get to that quickly. But just to put the wrap on this aspect of it was that, you know, what was very clear too was in third downs, what carried over from the second half of the season with Kyler, where he was playing, to pretty much all of 2022 in his playing, was the third and give up offense, where, you know, and we saw it a lot this year early on with Dobbs and then early on with Kyler, where on, you know, third and eights, you throw a 3-yard pass on a crosser and get dumped, from, you know, 4 yards from the stick. Or you catch the ball and throw a fade out of bounds. How many times did we see that? And suddenly Kyler can't hit a deep pass to save his life. How does that happen? Because he's getting the ball out too early or too, you know, he's not holding on. You know, he's overthrowing. It's just a mess. And, you know, and here's the thing that's been bothering me, continues to bother me, was the quitting in the Ram playoff game, which was Kyler's worst game ever in football, no doubt about it. There was so little fight in him in that game. It was just, I mean, Warren Sapp said out of the game, that wasn't an NFL quarterback. It was a playoff game and such little fight. And talk about third and give up, it was almost every play give up. And except that one play where he tried to scramble and then threw the interception for a pick six, you know, just threw it up in the air, which was a really tough play. But even there, it looked like he was just trying to, you know, take a dive and avoid contact. But here's the thing. How can anyone quit on that game when Buda Baker's been carried off on a gurney, putting his heart and soul into that game? And when J.J. Watt, who came to Arizona saying, I think Kyler can take us to the show, J.J. Watt worked his ass off that whole stretch it was one of the most miraculous things I've ever seen. Total reconstructed shoulder, had been ripped out of everything, tendons, joints, everything. He worked his tail off to come back for that game. And these are the guys you're walking out on? What the frick? I mean, how any quarterback could come back from that? I don't know how you could. And then the scrapping of the socials to follow. Like I'm quitting on the Cardinals. It's obvious. And, you know, so do you want to comment on that before we get to the Kyler now?
I mean, we, and I'll let Kyle Ledbetter, this is just going to be a quick one, and then he can go ahead and take it over after this. But we saw a hard, Lamar Jackson had to work just to get his bag. And I ask myself this question all the time. I always ask myself, if this wasn't, like, let's just say if Kyler Murray was with the Ravens or with any other established, like, team that has a strong, like, you know, press that can, you know, hold people down and has, you know, pretty much, like a culture of, like, winning and whatnot, would this play out the same? And I always ask myself that question, like, what if he played for the Ravens? What if he played for, you know, the Rams, even the Rams? Or what if he played for the Steelers, for the Vikings, for, like, other teams that had had, like, quarterback success, the Packers, like, all these other teams? What would be the Chiefs? I mean, obviously, the Chiefs would be, like, another team that I would consider. Like, what would happen in that circumstance? Do you see the same tactics play out that you did with the Cardinals, or is it because the Cardinals as a fan base, and it's sad for me to say, we're just so deprived of, like, having a good culture when it comes to winning and, you know, having continuity at the quarterback level, that one chance that we did get to draft that quarterback, and he became the best quarterback that we've ever drafted and not just, like, you know, signed and whatnot, that we are willing to, like, oversee a bunch of other stuff and get defensive if there's some sort of criticism or critique thrown at him, to the fact that we just get so upset if, like, something's not going right with Kyler Murray. Like, we point the fingers at the things around him, but we're not willing to point the finger at him. And it's not bad to say, hey, Kyler, you can be better at this. Like, me and you, Walter, we're not Kyler haters. We're not. Like, people can see us that way, and I don't care if they do. Like, they can see me that way and tell me and ostracize me as much as they can, but I'm a critic. I'm not going to lie about what I see on film. But I do want Kyler Murray to succeed. And for that reason, that's the reason why I'm doing the film study, so that we can point out what the things that he needs to improve upon so that he can become that all-pro generational, like, quarterback that we drafted. You can go ahead, Kyle.
Yeah, no, you guys covered the ground pretty well. You know, we've hashed over a lot of this stuff before. I think we're ready to move on to Kyler now.
Yeah, just want to piggyback on what Marco said there. There was so much good there. Because it's true. I mean, no one campaigned harder for the Cardinals to draft Kyler Murray than I did back when it was very unpopular to do so. Took the heat for that. But, you know, unfortunately, the Arizona culture for fans is just obsessive idolatry of the guys that they think are superstars.
Black and white.
And exactly, because, and what the Cardinals fans need to learn, and I got to write an article about this and probably give me a lot of shit, but what they really need to learn is that the worst place you can put anyone is on a pedestal, because it's the loneliest place in the world, and there's only one way out of it, and that's down. So, you know, look at across the board at the Phoenix sports stars who we've just, like, to this day, Marcos, I'm hearing fans on Twitter saying that the DeAndre Hopkins trade was the greatest thing the Cardinals ever did. And I'm just like,
that doesn't
you know, when he left town, I used the raising the sun quote, which I so love, is that when a thief doesn't run off with your money, he don't leave no roadmaps. I mean, that guy was a total thief and a user and abuser. It was just disgusting. Talk about quitting on a team. I mean, absolutely disgusting. So anyway, I don't want to shift gears off of Kyler, because now we're coming up to what could be the really good news, and I hope that it is. And like I said, but you know, Kyler, the hardest part for Kyler is, in my opinion, this year was winning back his teammates. Did he do that? I think he did a good job of doing that. Don't you?
Yeah, I think that, like, what he's been showing as far as, like, being more participatory and all sorts of other things, also being part of, like, the social media aspect of the Cardinals, like, you know, getting people riled up and stuff after the game, you know, after that Eagles game, you know, announcing, or I think it was the Pittsburgh game, where he announced, like, hey, let's go Red Sea and whatnot, and also being more critical, but in the right way, not being critical in, like, the, you know, like, I'm mad and, you know, like, I'm gonna let you know that I'm mad. No, actually telling people why he's mad, like, holding people accountable, like, the way he should as a quarterback, because you're supposed to expect perfection, especially from your team. So there's those factors. There's also the factor that, like, he's willing to do the things that he's being asked to do. And that was one point where I was thinking to myself, is this going to actually work out? Because Kyler Murray's comfortable from being a shotgun and being under center. Well, he's been getting under center, and he was doing it slowly but surely, but he was getting to that point where he was taking more snaps from under center, which is a great transition from what he was to what he wants to be. So as a person who critiques Kyler Murray, I will say that those are very good critiques of him that I do have, that he is willing to do what he needs to do going forward. Now, he has a big road ahead of him, especially during this offseason. So with this offseason, I would employ Kyler Murray to take every possible minute with his team to be able to get that connection and to be able to get those reps in, because obviously the draft is right around the corner and we have no idea how that's going to play out. But play out as it may, with whatever result we get, he needs to get on the field. He needs to lead the team. He needs to get on the same page with the offense, that with Drew Petzing as well, because he still has a lot to grasp when it comes to, like, running this under center wide zone scheme that will help him out with at least being able to dissect with better throws and not have to, like, bomb it down the field out of the shotgun every single play. This year, he'll actually be able to, like, be more of a, how should I say, a general and not just a what people expect him to be, which is like a superhero. And so doing that, and if he knows how to operate the offense well, he will have success. And I believe that he's at least at the right path of doing that.
Yeah. What the big difference that I saw was a sudden signs of humility, which I think are the key to success for any competitor, is, you know, you have to, you know, this game is going to humble you sometimes, and you have to lean into that humbleness that you get. And he was more critical of himself after games than normal, which I thought was really good. Much more mature, much more at ease with the media. Thought he handled himself with real poise. You know, just during the weeks and stuff, I think he handled the questions really thoughtfully. He's made enormous roads there. I mean, when he was a rookie, he couldn't handle the media. I mean, he was a fish out of water. And understandably so. He was so young, he'd only have one big year of college football. He needed a lot of reps with that. He also needed a lot of reps. He hadn't played much football. That's the other thing people forget about Kyler Murray is it's unbelievable to think this, but he only had one real season of college football other than three starts he had at A&M. Unbelievable. And a couple of cameo late game appearances in for Baker Mayfield back in 2017 or whatever it was. But we see it now. Here's the other thing, is that he's getting paid way more than any other player to be in that building, which I had said, and Kyle might remember this, one of the two things that I felt Kyler could do to really turn a page in terms of, turning it over a new leaf, would be to invest that money he's getting with, extra, what's it, $10.1 million he's getting extra for just training in the building, was invest that in his teammates.
He should buy a new set of weights and everything for the Cardinals not wanting to upgrade certain things. That would be so sad.
Well, yeah, I mean,
that would be an embarrassment for the Arizona Cardinals if they're making their star quarterback do that.
Yeah,
that would be great.
That would be such an embarrassment to Michael Bidwell, the billionaire who can't even afford to upgrade things in the franchise quarterback has to take it upon himself.
Yeah, that would be absolute embarrassment. Now, granted, I don't know if Bidwell does shame at this point, so I don't know how much shame actually works for him, but damn, that would be embarrassing for the Cardinals, and I would love it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's awesome. What a great idea. But do something with that or invest it in fan, paying for kids' tickets to the games, or, you could do something special with that. And secondly, I really felt like he ought to have class enough to give props to Cliff Kingsbury for his, for working with him and drafting him. And that would go a long way. Unfortunately, Kyler tried to, feed the fans with, we're doing things differently now, bullshit. I mean, it's just, that's just another just fabrication. I mean, he was the problem in the building, not Cliff, and you could see it in the meetings. You also knew he was coming in late, but we've gone over that all before. Let's wipe that clean for now. Coming into this season, he's coming off 8 games, nearly won, helped the team win 4 of them. Finished the season strong, first time ever, but it's an asterisk. It's kind of like starting on the back nine in a golf tournament, because he only played a half a season. The big questions are now, can he play a full season? Can he stay healthy for a full season? And can he be consistently productive and efficient? And my worries about him have been, he seems to, from series to series, you just don't know what you're going to get. A 3-and-out where he's overthrowing players out of bounds and just looks sort of clueless, or a sustained drive where, they've got play action going, and the way he connected with McBride, that was the most encouraging thing to me, was McBride, because, and we'll go back to Hopkins for a minute. And this is what makes me nervous about Marvin Harrison Jr., because Marvin Harrison Jr. is a tremendous talent. But I just don't know if he's the right fit for Kyler or for the Cardinals. Name me one wide receiver in Kyler's 5 years here where he had a tremendous rapport with from start to finish.
I think the only one I can even think about is Hopkins in the 2020 season, but they used him like a cheat code, and I believe that's what they would if they were to go with someone Roma Dunze and Marvin Harrison Jr. They're both the same type cats of tall gray hands receivers, although that I know Roma Dunze had a better contested catch rate, so like I've mentioned before, the dream scenario would be trade back, get that extra first round pick, and then end up with a Dunze. People should get excited about that. It just gives me anxiety thinking that the Cardinals could trade back and lose out of that. But I will say, I have listened to your podcast about Brock Bowers, the podcast that I was focusing on particularly was Brett Coleman and what he meant about his usage as a fullback.
Yes.
And
Right.
That actually put it into a lot of perspective when he brought
Right.
that up, because to me, at first I thought to myself, I think I'm fine with the tight ends we have in the room, because I like was it the second string
Higgins.
tight end?
Yep.
Yeah, Higgins,
Elijah
yeah.
Higgins. Yep.
Elijah Higgins, yeah, I do have belief in him. But
Yep.
if you do have a Brock Bowers on the team, if you do use him as that move fullback type of player, I think that would be a great fit to be able to do that if we also do trade back. So but yeah, like you mentioned, the only one that I can think about is just DeAndre Hopkins, but DeAndre Hopkins was just a opposite receiver, as the trips the opposite receiver to the trips formation, the alone X that Kyler Murray just was able to like reliably hit, because we always had him in a scheme where he was one-on-one with his corner. So I'm not
Right.
sure if that counts as real rapport, just like, hey, this is a great thing you guys got we got going over here. Let's try to abuse this as much as we can.
How did it end with Hopkins?
Well, unfortunately he got injured, and there was a situation where they both had a falling out, and DeAndre Hopkins, well, he did not give full effort on certain games and pulled himself out. So, yeah, I don't agree with the DeAndre Hopkins being like the best trade. It looks bad
Right.
after hindsight, and it actually looks like the Texans are getting back at the Cardinals now.
Yeah, it sure does. And it's funny how the football gods work. Because,
Well, we
when
shouldn't
they
have
made
talked.
the. Go ahead. What
No,
are you
we
saying?
shouldn't have talked all that mess. We shouldn't have celebrated. We should have just stayed quiet and waited to see how this would have turned out. Like, people were like rags, like they were ragging on the Texans bad. Like, whoa, what is wrong with you guys? You guys are a poverty franchise. And then we took, of course, JJ Watt signed with us for those 2 years, and we were just like making fun of them. Even our media team was making fun of them. Like, wow, these guys are just giving away players. And look what's going on now.
Right.
You know what's so funny, Marcos, is that it happened again, because last year during the draft, everyone was like, damn, the Texans gave up their top five pick in next year's draft. Damn, they're so stupid for giving away that pick to the Cardinals. Like, the exact same thing
Exactly.
happened again, to the point where it's like, the Cardinals didn't lose either of these trades, but they're just not as good as people thought they were at the beginning. Like, the Hopkins trade was still very much a win for the Cardinals. Why? Because they got a Hall of Fame receiver for 2 years who produced for a season and a half, and they gave up basically nothing in return for him. This the trade for Will
Well,
Anderson last year is go. Yeah, they gave up a second round pick. I know it's,
yeah,
and they dumped a bad contract. So,
good.
you know.
That's true.
That's the
Yep.
beneficiary. Like, they
Right.
still won the trade. It just wasn't the worst trade in NFL history like people thought it was at the beginning. And
Right.
on the flip side here, like, people thought the Cardinals were going to get a golden ticket because the Texans were inept with their draft day trade and were too excited to jump back up to number three. And the trade's
Right.
still probably going to work out for the Cardinals. It's just not as good as it was at the beginning. And that's
Right.
kind of the exact same situation happening twice, which I think is hilarious that it's the same team and the same situation twice, where like the trades are not bad, but they're just not the worst trades you've ever seen, like people thought it was originally for the Texans.
Well, what I
Jacob.
would argue about that is, see, I'm a big believer in the football gods. And as you know, and I know people will laugh at this, and that's fine. But it's funny how this always works. Like I've said at the time, caveat emptor on the Hopkins trade. Everyone's like, what the frick? I said, yeah, buyer beware. Look at the circumstances in which he's leaving there. And why he wants out after that playoff game where they had this big lead against the Chiefs and then blew it. What kind of a team player is that? He signs a 5-year deal. Second, it's just the biggest nightmare for any franchise where your star, You sign someone and give them what they want, and then 2 years later, they want a whole new thing. And whether you want to side with the player on that or not is another thing. But already threatening to hold out if he doesn't get a brand new contract because of it. Plus all the info that we got from Bill O'Brien about Hopkins creating his own practice schedule and how he didn't feel like that was a good role, being a good role model for the other players on the team, particularly young players. Now, for someone who's coached before, I know those double standards crush you. You can't win when you play by double standards with players. You just can't. I mean, that's the thing about Tom Brady. Here in New England, Tom Brady, you know, was like the hardest practice worker, and the fans were on him constantly. They didn't put him on a pedestal like we do in Arizona. If he had any, you know, even in wins, there'd be critiques of Brady and how he could be better. I mean, but the thing is that, I mean, Hopkins, this first year, you know how many targets he got? 160. That's 10 a game. I mean, and only caught 115. You know, that's hogball right there.
Yeah,
I mean,
and,
it'd be one thing if we made the playoffs, but we missed the playoffs. And by the end of the season, he was like the only viable receiving option on the team because it was the only one that Kyler had tried to build you know, chemistry with. Go ahead,
yeah,
Kyle.
To your point, of receivers that have clicked with Kyler Murray, it's a season and a half of DeAndre Hopkins. It's half a season of Trey McBride. Those are the standards at this point. What is it, 5 years into his career? Those are the two.
Right.
And, you know, you can say none of them ended well, but all that means is just the Hopkins situation didn't end well because that's the only one that's ended of the ones that Kyler Murray clicked
right.
with. And you could argue like Larry right. walking out at the end was a situation right. where it's like they never clicked and whatever
no,
it was, but
right.
But it's Hopkins and McBride. Those are the two.
So Kyler's worked with three Hall of Fame receivers, and leaving here, all three of them were not too happy. So that's kind of weird. Go ahead, Marcos.
Oh, Kyler also, well, I don't know if you guys believe this or not, but he's clicked very well with Greg Dortch as well. Actually, he's clicked better with Dortch than he did with Hollywood Brown. So that's another person that I believe is great that we not only brought him back, but he's clicked very well with Greg Dortch.
Yeah, in two games, though. Let's be honest. So it's a small sample. So hopefully that continues big time. And it looks like, you know, they're moving Dortch full time into the slot, which is really exciting. But we're going to see. They're probably going to draft two receivers in the draft. I just say one other thing. The one who came closest is Christian Kirk. And what was weird about that, and Kirk was dictating his own terms early on. He didn't want to play traditional slot. He wanted to play wide. And, you know, Kirk didn't really have that slot dog mentality. I mean, he's kind of a silky player who wanted to run deep crossers and stuff, and he did it well. And like that go route he ran against the Cowboys on Monday Night Football, or was it Thursday night or whatever, that was go time city. Kyler's best deep throws were to Christian Kirk. That, bail the pocket left against the Browns. That's one of the, I think that's the greatest Kyler play I've seen, other than the Hail Murray, which was phenomenal. But where he Kyler flushed to his left, squared his shoulders, and threw a dime 35 yards to the back pylon to Christian Kirk against the Browns in that great game where they beat the Browns handily in Cleveland. You know, but even there, the ending there was kind of dubious because, you know, there were reports on social media that from family members of Christian Kirk, thank God, to get away from Kyler. Weird.
Yeah, the Kirk situation ended quite strangely, and
right.
That yeah, I don't have the highest opinion of Christian Kirk just as a football player. I think he's a very good NFL receiver, and he was also probably should have been a number two or a number three. But at the same time, I think you're right about that being the closest third option. And to what Marcos brought up about Greg Dortch, you know, in a salary cap sport, it's great that after they tried, I mean, they basically gave up a first round pick for Hollywood Brown because the third rounder they got, Myjai Sanders, they cut after a season. So they gave up a first rounder for Hollywood Brown. They invested a second round pick in Rondale Moore, all trying to find people who could fill that slot type position. And the fact that they found that guy as an undrafted player from the organization, practice squad to special teams to someone who gets reps in a season at the end of 2022 that is going by the wayside, that's a testament to player development to the point where, like, you know, Walter brings up the point that he had three Hall of Fame receivers come through the Cardinals in Kyler's first 4 years. And in true Arizona Cardinals fashion, because whether it's Emmett Smith or whatever, in the history of the Cardinals, one of their reputations is they get the Hall of Famers when they're past their prime and are looking for a place to retire, because AJ Green wasn't the same player he once was. Hopkins' body broke down after a year and a half, and Larry Fitzgerald was not injured, but was obviously 39 years old while Kyler got Larry Fitzgerald playing with him. So I think it's interesting that Dortch is going to be committed as that slot type receiver this year, because in a salary cap sport, that's a testament to player development across multiple across multiple different coaching staffs and multiple different offenses. And I think it's good that he's getting the chance to get more repetitions with Kyler Murray, because it's a testament to your player development in a salary cap sport as you're going through a rebuild.
Yeah. And just as an FYI, I heard Steve Kimes say once that Rondale Moore was Kyler's suggestion, one of the players that Kyler put in for,
and that makes sense. It makes sense why they drafted him as high as they did.
Yeah, except that they never had much of anything. And you know, here's the other thing is that, you know, what Kurt Warner did when he got here was to create this sort of Matthew Stafford-esque chemistry with all his receivers, not just one, not just two, but all, and get them all on the same page to the point of, where do you want me to throw it? Do you like it, you know, about belt? You like it up at the numbers? I mean, that kind of precision, which I'm sure Stafford does too. And now that he's around in this offseason and can do that, particularly when we're going to make probably two key additions. We'll talk about that now. But just as an FYI, you know, hopefully whoever they bring in here, Kyler can be, you know, get in sync with quickly. My feeling is right off the bat, if you want the guy who's going to be an immediate connection with Kyler, it's Bowers. After what I saw Kyler do with McBride, having one of those guys, a queen on the chessboard on both sides of the ball, on both sides of the formation, or even in tandem. Oh, my God, the thought of that. And as Narcos mentioned, you know, Bowers is an H-back. We don't have an H-back. There's no one on the roster currently who fits that mold. So you can move him around, motion him. The way you can get creative with him, as the 49ers do with both Kittle. So they do this with Kittle. They put Kittle in motion, but they also put Jusek in motion. I mean, Bowers can be a combination of both, and both are Pro Bowl players. And most of the scouts that I trust the best all think Bowers has Hall of Fame potential. Because of his toughness, because of his hands, he's you know, the slipperiest guy up a seam as a tight end in a long time. Plus, you know, look at what he accomplished. He was the stud wide receiver in a program that lost, what, 2 games in 3 years? And won two natties, where he was the premier player on offense right from the get-go, even as a freshman. You know, there's just a lot of great things there with him. That plus, it's within the confines. It's so in the spirit of this offense that you're trying to run, and you're now attacking the middle of the field, which is what Super Bowl winners do. All that makes sense to me. The Marvin Harrison situation does not make sense to me, because it's going to divert attention away from doing the inside stuff that they need and do more of the Hopkins outside stuff that I thought at times was to the detriment of the entire team. And particularly if the catch rate, you know, the target versus catch rate is lower than you would expect. And I think that it's going to take a while for any rookie at an X to learn how to get open frequently in the NFL. But let me ask you this, and I've been eager to ask Marcos this, and I prompted him yet last night. And I'm really eager to hear Kyle's answer afterwards. Now in retrospect, a year later, was the Cardinals trade a boon or a bane? The big trade, plus the taping of it and going viral with that, which I want to get into. And let me just, as a one scenario to ponder, is to think if the Cardinals could have had Will Anderson and Brian Branch, arguably two of the top five defensive players in that draft, on the same team together, had they just stayed at one, at, you know, with their first two picks. Marcos, hit it. What do you think?
I wasn't a big fan of the trade, mostly because of the fact that, like you just mentioned, we did have to give up a pick. After we gained the pick and moved back, we had to give up a pick to move back down. Right. And just like you just mentioned, maybe we could have just stayed, which I thought the best solution for us was just to stay put, because what we're doing right now at the outside linebacker position, we still don't have an answer for who's going to be the, you know,
right,
the stalwart there. Right. We're trying out Zaven, of course, at that position, which to me, it's just ridiculous. I think they're doing that just so they can have an excuse to not pick up his fifth-year option, because they know he has to develop right at the outside linebacker right position, so they can justify not picking up his fifth-year option if that's the case. And obviously, if you're an inside linebacker, you're just not getting your fifth-year options picked up either way. And, you know, not having that stalwart at the outside linebacker position and watching Will Anderson play the way he played, starting right out the bat as a rookie, it's just like remake right of what we keep doing when it comes to like passing up these blue chippers. Now, right, after the move back, and I'm like, okay, we gave up that pick, and now we gained that for extra first round pick this year, and we have that second round pick in the second round. There are positions that we had that we definitely needed to go aggressive on, one being cornerback and the other one being possibly like a defensive tackle, and maybe even a center. We could have addressed those needs, but we decided to move back down, and we moved right back down to get Paris Johnson, because obviously there was talks about him going to the Raiders or him going to like other teams, and he wasn't going to be available. Well, in that situation, I would have just stayed at the position that I'm at. And if I really did need a tackle, which, by the way, the Cardinals need to stop focusing so much on tackle. They need to start addressing that middle of the field, especially right, it, or that middle part of the offensive line, especially if Kyler Murray is going to be your quarterback. He needs more protection up front than he does in the edges, because if those correct edges were to cluster him back in, he's not winning that battle if those offensive linemen are getting pushed back into him, because he right loses that vision at that point. Right. So they really are focusing more on the outside, and with doing that pick for Paris Johnson, they went ahead and, you know, focused on that outside part and pretty much neglected other positions that we really needed in order to fast track this rebuild, in order to move up for an individual who I didn't even really think that they needed to draft, like specifically because of the fact that we saw what Josh Jones did the year before and taking over that starting position at left tackle. You could have let go of DJ Humphries at that point, replaced him with Josh Jones, and Josh Jones was in the system. He was in the building. He had a great PFF grade. He showed that he was able to, you know, take over. The fans weren't ripping their hair out at his pass protection last year because it was really great. So for somebody who's starting out and getting action for the first time in his career, like consistent action. So if it was true that the reason why they did want to move off of like DJ Humphries eventually was to draft the person who's going to be taking over after him, why is Paris Johnson not being talked about being moved to the left tackle position then?
Exactly.
Like he's staying at the right. If the goal was, hey, we need somebody else for left tackle. Now we're talking. Now there's some, you know, people mentioning that we should draft another tackle after another year. And I did the research, and remember, I didn't stop when I came to my Excel spreadsheets because I have to go year by year. But I sent them to you for review, and every time I looked at it year by year, the first tackle of the NFL draft isn't always the best tackle. As a matter of fact, it's usually somebody like either picked third in it or picked in the second, third round. And it's harder to develop tackles in the NFL due to the restrictions of practice. The learning curve has become more difficult. So hitting on a tackle has become more of like a, let's just say like the talent level is starting to decrease. Where it used to be like, you have to draft a tackle in the first round. Well, yeah, because back then, the NFL was predicated on longer developing plays. Wide receivers weren't as fast to run downfield. Quarterbacks had to hold onto the ball longer. And there was a lot of run. It was a run-heavy scheme. So you really needed to hit on that tackle early on. And that talent level was wider. Now the talent level is shorter between the worst tackles and the best tackles. Because the quarterback doesn't have to hold on to the ball as often or as long. So
Correct.
That as it may, if that's the case, you need to draft heavy at offensive linemen, but you need to do it throughout the draft. You don't need to focus on that first tackle and think to yourself, that guy's going to take over. Because I know that the AZ media isn't speaking about it, but Paris Johnson's year was an up and down year. And to give up a pick to move up in the top 10 to get a tackle that didn't perform as the best tackle of last year's draft. On the contrary, his teammate was picked in the fifth round, had a stellar year over Paris Johnson. Like, we need to see more from that. We need to see him play the natural position and take over at that. We know that's left tackle. After DJ Humphries got let go, That should have been a given, and it's not the case. So that's number one. Number two, he better be on a trajectory of being an all-pro type of tackle if you're giving up that many picks for him. If people want to give crap at Isaiah Simmons for not becoming that all-pro, like, inside linebacker, we didn't move up to get Isaiah Simmons. We stuck and picked him in the top 10, and he was set to go in top 5 in that year's draft. Same people that are criticizing them are the ones who are like jumping for joy when we first got him. So, I mean, like, if you're willing to hold him accountable for his projection, even though he had Vance Joseph as a defensive coordinator, you have to do the same with Paris.
Right. Yep. Kyle?
So I second Marcos's points about Paris Johnson almost to a T, is that trading two first round picks essentially for Paris Johnson, because what they basically gave up was pick 12 and 33 for pick 6, and then they moved up, they did a pick swap later in the draft that, you know, is important but is less important context wise because you could argue they did the pick swap but they also lost a pick swap because they had to move with the Eagles because of the tampering thing. It was basically a third for fifth swap or whatever. So they basically gave up 6 for 12 and 33, which that's the only part that is critical of the trade itself, because I think they got very good value for Will Anderson when they made that trade. The Paris Johnson point I'll bring up, the only thing that I disagreed with Marcos on is that I don't think he has to be on all pro trajectory in order for that trade to be a success. It just, he can't be a four and out player, basically. It can't be 4 years, we declined the fifth year option, and now he's a free agent who's going to sign a 1 or a 2 year contract somewhere else. I think there's a medium space in between where it's like, okay, he's better than a four and out player, but maybe he's not all pro best left tackle or one of the two best left tackles in the NFL. I don't think it has to be that or that. I think there's a medium space where that trade can be a success. I've said if he is the starting tackle for the Arizona Cardinals for 8 to 10 years, you can make a clean argument that it was worth trading up from 12 to 6 in order to lock down that position for close to a decade. If you can say that position is set and giving you above average, maybe occasionally Pro Bowl production, that is a successful trade for going to get Paris Johnson Jr. Whether he gets to that point, time will tell. I said the same thing at the draft last year as it relates to the Will Anderson portion that is still true now, and I have not, you know, wavered on this point, which is everyone last year in the draft was saying Will Anderson Jr. is the number one prospect. At least most people were saying it's either him or Jalen Carter, but for the most part, people were saying Will Anderson Jr. is the number one best prospect. Since he was 16 years old, he's been identified as this guy's going to be a first-round pick, kicked ass at Alabama, and now is going to be a top-five pick.
Yep.
If Will Anderson is that guy, and he's going to be like a Myles Garrett type of anchor to your defense, who since he was 16 years old, you know he's going to be a first-round pick, and he's physically grown into his own body, and now he's the number one or number two prospect, and the only debate is one or two. And he's an edge rusher at a premium position. If he is that caliber of player, there is no amount of picks you can offer me to make me trade out of that spot. Now, the question was whether or not Will Anderson was viewed that way by the Cardinals organization. The Cardinals ultimately decided we would rather take the 3 first-round picks and a third rounder in exchange for Will Anderson. And I say 3 first-round picks because they got the first pick of the second round from the Texans, which is basically first-round players at second-round prices. And they basically got 3 first-round picks in exchange for Will Anderson, which I think is a great value. And most people agreed after the draft that is great value, regardless of, you know, whether the Texans end up with a top 5 pick or a top 10 pick or whatever it was. The Texans overpaid to move up in the draft. Now, Will Anderson Jr. looks like he's going to be a very, very good player, and the Cardinals are probably going to regret not having him at that point. But I think both can be true in that there were questions about whether or not he was that Myles Garrett type of anchor to a defense, and the Cardinals traded out of what will be probably a better player than they could get at number 4 in this year's draft, per se. Like, there's not a player at number 4 available that was as talented going into the draft as Will Anderson was last year at any position. So from that point, I think the Cardinals gave up on what could have been the best prospect they could have had in the rebuild, but I don't think the trade was I forgot what the second term you used for it was. I don't think it was a boon. It wasn't a bane. The trade was not a bane because they got tons of picks and value added to that value in the fact that they traded down with the Titans so they could get Will Levis and add an additional third rounder this year. So you can add to that value point there. I think, like Marco said, a lot of the Cardinals' success in this trade will hinge both on Paris Johnson Jr.'s development and whatever they do at 27. Because after the Cardinals, assuming they sit tight and draft at 27, that trade is basically done. Like, the trade is Will Anderson Jr. for Paris Johnson, whoever they draft at 27, and whoever they picked with that fifth round pick swap last year. I don't remember who it was now.
And they they get a third.
Yeah. Too. Yeah. And so and that trade,
it's done when after the third round pick that they got.
Yeah.
So we're adding two more players. The question will wind up being at the end of the day, you know, is Paris Johnson plus all the maneuvering to get Johnson, but it's Paris Johnson plus who they get at 27 and who they get in the third round. Oh, plus the Cardinals gave the Texans a pick.
Yeah, they did. That's what I was saying. Like, it's tough to follow all of it because when they made the trade with the Lions for Paris, there was also a pick swap involved. So the Cardinals like moved up a couple rounds.
Right.
But then you could say like, well, they had to make the exact same pick swap backwards for the Eagles deal. It's hard to follow some of that stuff. But the bulk of the trade is Paris 27, the third rounder afterwards, and then whoever they picked in the fifth round last year. Maybe it was the Stills pick. I don't remember which one it was, but there's another player that they got out of the deal last year.
What's tantalizing is when you look at the ripple effects of things that happened with the decision making. First of all, as I've been saying all along, I still can't understand how a new GM and new coach comes through the door saying alignment, and then the players they pick to hitch their wagons to and name their own captains, which I think is deplorable in today's football or in any football. It's a game for the team. Team should elect its own captains. But just the same, here's what's tantalizing. So if you took Will Anderson, you don't have to move Zaven Collins to the edge to try to compensate. So Collins stays at the mic where he had 100 tackles the previous year. Kaiser White, now who you just signed, slides right into his comfortable role that he played in Philly, where he's in the weak inside linebacker position. Let's not forget, he's a converted safety who physically is not a Mike prototype, and he couldn't hold up physically, and hopefully this year he will, and hopefully they'll kick him over. But now it seems like they're not going to do that again. They're going to keep Zaven on the edge, keep Kaiser at Mike, and then Mac Wilson's going to slide in at weak inside linebacker. I think that's the plan. But or maybe they'll flip flop Wilson and White. But notice how this affected. Imagine coming into the season. Plus, then in the beginning of the second round, you can now take Brian Branch. I mean, that combination in itself, you've added two potential Pro Bowlers at key positions with edge and at slot corner, which is so valuable. In the NFC West, we need two of them, as I've been saying, because of the slot tandems that are prolific. I mean, Kupp and Nacua, are you kidding me? Lockett and Smith and Jigba, are you kidding me? You know, Debo and Ayuk. And now Jennings and now McCaffrey on the other side. Oh, my God.
Yeah, right? The reason I didn't bring up the Branch point is that, like, yes, in hindsight, every team in the second round wished that they had picked Brian Branch, including the Arizona Cardinals, who took B.J. Ojulari four picks before Brian Branch got selected.
Yeah, and that whole...
Of course they did.
The thinking of that, and Marcos said it, documented it really well, is trading back up to... Now, at one point, so let's say, all right, we went with the trade to get all these extra picks. All right, I get it. But you better have a plan in mind to get address the edge. We haven't had that plan yet. I mean, B.J. Ojulari is a nice player. I'm not sure he's a regular starter. It depends on what you're doing with your defense. Let me check out his run grades. I don't know how good he was against the run, But also, let's remember that you drafted him coming off a knee injury. And, you know, I still can't get those day two picks. All three had medical red flags. I have 56.9 dirt versus the run. It's not very good. I had 22 tackles total. And, you know, and that's not bad. It's not terrible. So he could probably step up there. He's just smallish in stature is what I'm saying. And that and he just hit a wall last year. I mean, he was got off to a pretty decent start, but then down the stretch got shut out in the last six games. So that was difficult. So anyway, is there any comparison between BJ Ojulari and Will Anderson Jr.? I mean, seriously. Then you look at Garrett Williams. He was out. I mean, coming back from a knee injury, he comes back late. He was decent, but you know, I think they tagged him as a slot corner. I'm not sure he's got that in him. I don't think he's made to order. I think he's a boundary corner or a free safety. But I like the player. I like the player, especially now that he's healthy. I think he could be really good for us. But I'm not sure, and I think he could take certain. I think he could cover Nacua, for example, or some of the bigger slots, like Ayuk. Maybe he could cover. You need another faster guy. But then, then Michael Wilson, who was, I think, my favorite of the bunch, you know, kind of showed out. He played well when he had his chances, and he had chemistry with Kyler down the stretch. I like him at X just fine. What I want is guys we can attack the middle with. You know, by the way, Elijah Higgins can play wide receiver as well. He's a tall. He played it at Stanford. So he's a versatile guy if you need larger wide receivers too. And I really like the kid on the practice squad from Colorado. What Arias, look out for him this preseason. He's going to be a busy guy. Really loved what I saw from him last year. He seems to run the post really well. So anyway, what's going to depend, you said it well, Kyle, we got to find out who this 27th pick is. What was tantalizing to me was for a second there, after the trade down, we had the 12th pick, and we had the 33rd and 34th picks, which to me, like you say, Kyle, almost like having three first rounders, mm-hmm. right?
No, it basically is, because you don't get the fifth year option, but you get first round prospects right. at second round prices, because right. some team's going to reach for a player they really like in the first round.
Plus, going home first night, and you know you're going to get two of the first three players. You could really narrow in and get them straight, you know, what you want. You know, that's a luxury unto itself. I mean, but what wound up happening is we never picked at 33 or 34 and didn't have a second first round pick.
Yep.
And had to wait till 41. And amazingly, Brian Branch was still there, and that would have been the steal of the draft. And you go with a guy who couldn't work out because he had a knee injury. Just weird.
To answer your original question, I went back and figured out who the player was. So it was last year, the trade down, they got a pick from Detroit that ended up being Clayton Tune. So the winding version of the trade in the simplest form I can provide it, like crossing out some pick swaps that we can say cancel each other out. The simplest form I can say is that it's Will Anderson Jr. in exchange for Paris Johnson Jr., Clayton Tune, the 27th pick, and the third rounder this year. That's the simplest variation of the trade that I can explain it to people.
With the Detroit trade. Oh, yeah, the Detroit trade. All right, and let me put it to you this way, too, is with guess who pick 33 was?
Oh God, let me remember. Joey Porter was 32.
Joey Porter, right?
Joey Porter was 32 because remember the Dolphins got their pick docked in the first round.
Exactly.
So, who was 33?
Well, 33. The Cardinals traded out with the Titans.
Oh, that was Levis. Okay,
Now I'm looking at that pick and salivating because I liked Levis a lot. He might have solved our quarterback problems early last year. And we had to go through that whole charade with Dobbs. And man, you got a guy in house who with a quarterback alongside of Murray who's injury prone. Boy, what a 1-2 punch that they could have been. Man, I love the way Levis played for the Titans. I was very impressed. And then with the ones they traded to the Lions, who did they take?
I do not know that. Oh, interesting.
I mean, the Lions are just crushing drafts left and right. I mean, so they get Laporta in that trade from the Cardinals. I mean, really? I mean, imagine him opposite McBride. I mean, plus you had picks. You had guys there like Steve Avila, the guard. He had a pretty decent year for the Rams. He looks like a real, you know, core player for them. You know, there were other guys in there that could have been interesting, especially Brian Branch.
So connecting this back to the Anderson trade originally, the Cardinals trade out of those picks and they get some bonus, you know, capital to work with, and a lot of that is in this year's draft. So to the point about boom or I forgot what the other word you called it, Bane, was it?
Well, that's a little heavy.
Yeah, but to the point about that is that most of the trade is going to be done and set at the end of this draft, and we'll know the players who will hopefully be a part of the future because, you know.
And we won't know for a couple of years how those players worked out. So you're absolutely right. Too early to tell.
But the underlying point is that from when Gannon first got here to now, you've got about 60 to 70% of the roster completely turned over once this draft is complete.
All right. So here's my thing. See, I go back to the football gods, that video. I mean, awesome to watch, but fucked up to send out virally. I mean, you just don't do that. It's just really fucked up that they did that. I mean, you know, it's flaunting. Okay. This is what the Cardinals do. They did the same thing in the Hopkins trade, like the fans and the, you know, all this gushing, you know, wow, we got the stole, you know, we captured the Holy Grail, you know, this is the greatest thing ever. And, you know, that kind of flaunting, that's called hubris. The gods don't like hubris. Okay. So, I mean, I love seeing the video. Don't get me wrong. But, I mean, if you're Nick Caserio and you've just made this trade and suddenly that's going around, you know, getting millions of hits on social media, what the fuck are you thinking? I mean, you know, you got to think about somebody else. And you know, I mean, who wants to trade up this year to get a new viral video of Monty? You know, to the point where, and here's where it just got awful, was, you know, like Phoenix's headline after the first night of the draft, Cardinals dominate Texans in draft trade. You know, like dominate. Oh, really? Well, who's dominating now? The football gods had something to say with this, because one team came out of that draft saying, you know, we have a new head coach, but we're going to dare to try to win. We're trying to get aggressive and get after this thing. And you got another GM and new head coach who could give a shit about winning the first year. And it showed up. And now look at where they are. We've got one team's heading towards the, you know, on a path to the Lombardi. And another team, I mean, we're sitting here 2 weeks before the draft and we're talking about offensive players when our defense was the worst in the league. It's just unbelievable. I mean, and they haven't addressed key positions like edge rusher. Oh, wow, yeah, Will Anderson. Gee, what could have, would have been? And it compounded by the fact that this is, here's the thing, this is the most, the probably the least amount of edge talent we've seen in a draft in ages. The slim pickings. And whoever you're going to have to draft, I mean, the only one probably who's Dallas Turner or top 12, but they're not going to do that. They're not going to do that because they're like stuck on receiver and all the fans are all agog and this and that. But here's the thing. Here's the other thing. This is the deepest draft at wide receiver maybe ever. I mean, you don't have to. There's so many good receivers. I will guarantee you this right now, that barring people are healthy, Ladd McConkey will have more receiving yards than any than Harrison or Adunze. I'll guarantee you that right now. And someone will be the new Nacua. It might be Malachi Corey. It might be Xavier Leggett, who is Debo Samuel plus. I mean, there's this just, you know, so the focus of this draft just seems so askewed. And let's take it from there, because let's finish up with what I want to know from you guys is, what do you want to see the Cardinals do in the first round? You decide what you want them to do right now. I'd like to hear what you like to, you know, you're looking forward to. Marcos, let's start with you. Kyle will come with you, and then I'll finish it.
Well, I don't want to have the anxiety of last year when we did do the trade up. I mean, the trade out, and then obviously we traded back in, because now things aren't certain, and it looks like, just like you mentioned, the Texans actually dominate the Cardinals, at least in retrospect right now. And so the only way this doesn't play out well is if, like I mentioned, Paris Johnson becomes like a stable, like an all-pro left tackle or right tackle, doesn't really matter, and Will Anderson is injury-prone and just doesn't produce for the rest of his career, plus the players that we draft like with that trade as well, you know, right, these guys become starters and whatnot.
Right.
I am a person who is a Marvin Harrison like stan, that I will, you know, admit to that. And the only reason why I'm admitting to that is because, given the talent that like Kyler Murray, like what I see from Kyler Murray film wise is that he's inconsistent targeting the middle of the field, and he's right, inconsistent in being able to like do it. It's not that he can't do it, it's just that the consistency isn't there. So that's the reason why you had somebody like Christian Kirk leave the Cardinals and then immediately get a 1,000-yard season, because he had a system and a quarterback that could target him over the field way more consistently, where he was able to operate. Where with the Cardinals, he either had to be relegated to the outside, or when he did play in the slot, those middle targets weren't as consistent as they should be. So that's why we heard that rumor about the, you know, the family just like telling Christian Kirk, you know, not really having a high like opinion about Kyler Murray. And, you know, the one thing that I've seen Kyler Murray succeed in is being able to throw it to players that are get up and get it type of players. We saw that with Trey McBride, and we saw it with Michael Wilson, people that came back to the ball, people that fought for the ball, right, which is why, like, even if we were to trade back, like, my two scenarios is either stick and pick at number 4, Marvin Harrison, or we trade back and either get Brock Bowers or Roma Dunze, who are two get-up-and-get-it players. Like, right, two types of players that can benefit Kyler Murray, where he can throw it at a player that has a big radius. And the reason why I'm warming up to Brock Bowers is because we could use him as that, just like I said, that fullback position. So those are my scenarios. I'd be happy with either of the three.
Good stuff. Kyle?
So with number 4, assuming they're going to draft a skill position player, I would go with either Marvin Harrison Jr. or Brock Bowers. I'm less familiar with Malik Nabers' game because I haven't really watched much of him, and I trust other people's judgments when they say that him and Odunze are probably a tad below Marvin Harrison Jr. in the receiver rankings when it comes to their pure prospect grades, regardless of fit or whatever else we want to talk about with Marvin Harrison Jr., which I know, Walter, you've written extensively about and we've talked about on previous podcasts. Most draft scouts I hear put Nabers below that, but I don't have the same reference point on how good or bad a prospect Nabers is. In terms of which one they go and draft, I would hope that they consult with Drew Petzing before they make the draft pick, because one thing that I think is overlooked a lot in football is that the best offensive coordinators are able to adapt and evolve what they do based on the personnel that they have around them. They're able to recognize that the most important thing is the players that they have on the team. And the coordinators who very often get fired are the ones who pigeonhole themselves with less talented players to try and fit a scheme that has flaws or doesn't fit the roster with which they're working with. I think that's something that very often gets overlooked when we talk about offensive coordinators and their abilities. So I would hope that they consult with Drew Petzing, because Drew Petzing wants to run more 12 personnel and run and like control-based offense, which I'd argue is being more of a follower than like innovating and adapting the NFL offenses. Like everyone is trying to do that now. And I think the teams that aren't good at it are pigeonholing themselves instead of trying to find new and innovative ways to win games and adapt and evolve offense. But Drew Petzing in his first year was very good at adapting to different personnel packages that he had on the field and to the different quarterbacks that he was playing with. What they were running with Dobbs and Michael Wilson was very different than what they were running when it was Kyler and McBride and Greg Dortch and Rondale Moore at the end of the season. They evolved and adapted as the season went along based on the quarterback and the personnel that they had. Also when James Conner was battling injuries as well. And so what I think is most important is just consult with your guy and see what he thinks about bringing in a Marvin Harrison versus a Brock Bowers. I think both of those prospects are going to be great in the NFL, but whoever they pick, you better get it right, because you're not going to get a more talented player in your entire tenure as a general manager, Monty Ossenfort, than you expect to in this year's draft. And then at pick 27, draft a cornerback. Hopefully one of the four big name corners falls to them. I still love Kool-Aid McKinstry. I still love Enos Rakestraw. Those are good 5 and 6 options. Draft a corner at 27, and then at 35, we go from there. Maybe draft an edge, figure out what you want to do, and add some pieces to the defense after that fact.
All right, thank you. Good, beautifully summarized about looping in Petzing. Now, Monty has vowed that the organization will be in complete sync and alignment. So I imagine that Petzing has been given his 2 cents or more than that.
We
They've
say that, but when Rondale Moore got picked, I don't think Cliff Kingsbury was really in connection with that draft pick, because he didn't really know how to use Rondale Moore in that first season.
Well, no, I mean, neither did Petzing. So at some point, you got to realize, like this kid in the University of Binghamton, New York, valedictorian speech or senior speech at graduation said, learning that when I had to have a third roommate, maybe I was the problem. I mean, because, I mean, Rondale was just flaky. I mean,
No,
he
I just
just.
meant that in the sense that there are dozens of stories of general managers making decisions without, like my favorite example of all time, which is that they sent Jack Del Rio out to get dinner while they drafted Blake Bortles in the 2014 draft.
Oh, beautiful. Exactly. So I think they probably will be more in aligned, especially in year two of this draft. What I do not want to see is a trade down and then trade back up again. To me, that's silly. I mean, I want them to keep their number 35 pick in the second round this year. I don't want to have to be you know, looking at other teams picking at the top of round two, like we did last year. That was frustrating because there's going to be some really good players there. I think it's the temptation will be to want to stay after, you know, all the pressure that Cardinals fans are putting on the Cardinals for Marvin Harrison. But if they can get a good deal to trade down, here's my thing about that. If you can get the Vikings to trade up and you get that 23, if you trade down to 11, you can address this, you know, you can take, if Bowers is there, you can grab him, but you can still then come right back and get one of the top edge players at 23 and then one of the top corners at 27. And if you can start off the draft that way with getting a great playmaker that fits your style of offense, and I think McCaffrey does too really well. McCaffrey can play anywhere. He's like a faster version of Cooper Kupp in my mind. And quite a bit faster, actually. I mean, McCaffrey crushed it at the combine. There are other players in here who are really special. And I think that, you know, you can wait on the receivers and get a dandy. Like, they could do that. Can you imagine if they traded down, got Bowers at 11, and then got, let's say, Leetu Latu at 23, who may slide a little because of the medicals. But in his case, I'm pretty convinced he's going to be fine after 2 years of playing at such a high level. And if the doctors clear him, I don't have an issue with that. Or you got Chop Robinson there, who I think is going to be really good once he gets his technique down, and because he can really peel it off that edge. And then you can come back with one of those really good corners. Cooper DeJean could be there then. My favorite is Mike Sainra still. If we don't come out of the first round with him, I'm really, really disappointed. The best slot corner in the draft, plus he's a two-year captain at Michigan. I mean, but then let's say you got Bowers, you got Latu and Sainra still, and now in the first early of second round, you could double back. I mean, if McCaffrey's still there, I think McCaffrey would go in first round. But look at the guys who could be there. You know, Xavier Worthy, who they've looked at, who's the fastest guy in the draft. I mean, you could have complimentary guys there. Troy Franklin is a guy I love, not even getting much. And my favorite of all is Roman Wilson. Roman Wilson is just, he's going to make some team really special. I mean, we came back with that load right there off of trading down, where you got those four guys, I'd be delirious. And then you come back in the third and try to get some of those, you know, out of interior pass rusher. You know, so, yeah, I mean, I think trading down makes the most sense. My worry is everyone will, you know, think, oh, wow, you should have stayed put last year. Like, we're arguing with Will Anderson, and they'll do it again, or this time they won't do it. But, I mean, if it ends up they draft Marvin Harrison Jr., you know, I've already vowed this. I'm going to be excited. I don't know what that's going to mean, where the focus is going to be for him in that offense. And I don't think you draft a guy like that and just, you know, only give him limited targets a game. So, you know, and it would be interesting to see how, like you said, Kyle, you said it really well. Will Petzing be a guy who's going to, like, evolve this thing from year to year with the personnel he gets? And I guess it would behoove him. I just really love the way they were doing it, though, with the running game and the wide zone blocking scheme and the tacking over the middle. You know, Kyler was getting better at over the middle because of McBride and because of Dortch. And Michael Wilson, by the way, was catching really good stuff over the middle from Kyler. I just really loved how they, and Kyler's completion percentage was going up. Really just loved they, I just loved them to keep focusing on that.
Yeah, I understand your point there, but that's players that fit schemes and do things like that are what you do with pick 35, what you do with third round picks. That's what you do later in the draft is when the players are of similar skill and ability to each other and do different things, but ultimately not, you know, there's a 50% hit rate on third round picks for players who will last longer than 3 years in the league. When it comes to those day two and day three picks, that's when you start to draft more for scheme. When it comes to those top of the draft picks, you get the most talented players you can possibly get and put them in positions to succeed. And that's right. The important part is why they should communicate with Petzing is because whoever they pick at number four is the creme de la creme of this rebuild. This is the player that you spent 2 years losing to be able to get. And if you make that selection of, say, Marvin Harrison Jr., without conferring with Drew Petzing, well, now you're
that's never going to happen. They're not going to like, hey, by the way, Petzing, we're drafting. He's going to be in.
Or if that's not the player that Petzing wants or something along those lines, if you're putting it in a position where Petzing is being forced upon him, let's go with a situation where they draft Neighbors at four and Petzing is saying, no, I that's not the receiver that I want to build for this offense. Well, if that's what Austin Fort believes and Austin Fort's going to go ahead, Austin Fort better be right because Petzing's going to fall on the sword first and then, you know, that he's kind of the fall guy in that situation. But that's all, you know, it's just the pick is so important that you get whoever the most talented player is and build scheme around whoever you pick, whether that's Bowers, whether that's Harrison Jr., whether that's Neighbors, maybe a Dunze, but I don't think they'll be taking a Dunze at four if they sit there. That's the player that you draft and kind of build scheme around.
Right. Good point. All right. So I think we covered a fair amount of ground here today, 2+ hours. And Marcos, as always, it's always great to have you on and to tap into your resourcefulness and your thoughtfulness about NFL things from a true analyst standpoint. I love the way you break down tape. I love the way you form your own opinions. You go and look see before you take someone else's word for it. That is really impressive to me. I wish more fans would do that. Cause then it's easier on those who do, who might think, you know, I went and looked and you know what? There was some things I'm concerned about. This guy was, you know, he was great at this, but he was not so good at this. I mean, it's always good to have a tempered kind of well-researched opinion, and you are the epitome of that. So thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure. And, you know, ever since I took upon, like, trying to learn about scheme and trying to learn about, like, you know, what's the ins and outs of, like, an offense and a defense, just like you mentioned, it's one thing to hear a broadcaster or for somebody to say like, hey, this is what I think happened. And slowly but surely you learn like the intricacies of why things happen. And then it gives you a better understanding. And then you can conform to like, you know, a different assessment when it comes down to it. So I just wanted to be able to cover my, my ins and outs with, my assessments and whatnot. And just to build forward and keep studying. And hopefully, you know, if this is something that we can like raise like all boats, all like, I forgot what the term is, a rising tide lifts all boats. So basically like,
oh, yeah.
if you rise the Red Sea tide up higher, you know, then, you know, people would have to start like, you know, conforming to like, hey, you know, we're just going to have to like, instead of just putting our hot takes out there, we're just gonna have to start doing our research and assessments, because it ain't good enough to just say, hey, I think this player sucks and I think this player is great.
That's it. And I don't know about you, but I'm sick of hearing the word generational. but before, I mean, you know what Bill Parcells said about potential? It means you haven't done shit yet. So, you know, But yeah, thank you for that. Kyle, your parting words today?
I am just grateful that Marcos was here to break down some Kyler Murray film and have that conversation with us. He is quite a star when it comes to Arizona Cardinals content. And I think at this point, one of our best friends of the show at this point, I think I'll have to go back and review the tape, but of our 140 episodes, I think Marcos may be our most frequent and recurring guest on the show after all these years.
See that? Wow. It's Woo-hoo. The Labrada special.
Hey, it's my dream. Hey, I made it. I made it. I'm not even joking. I did want to make it to this podcast eventually. So I am going to say that this is a humbly saying and being serious. I am very honored that you guys not only keep asking me to come back, and not only that, but you asked me for my what my takes are and what I think, which means that I'm doing something right, at least, right?
That's it. Yep. And because we know that you've put good thought and research into it. It's not just I read in a magazine that, you know, how great this guy is. You actually provide the eye tests and you do your homework. We don't need a homework clause in your contract.
Oh, that's, yeah. No, I do. No, I do the homework and I do it willingly.
All right, with that said, and we don't have to pay you $10.1 million to show up either. That's really wonderful. And one day you'll get paid for this, hopefully, because you're on the right track. Thanks to both Marcos and to Kyle Little Rock for this two-hour power hour, hours or whatever. We got it flowing. It was like lava. And if you've been with us for the whole 2 hours, kudos. And we much appreciate it. Our numbers have been really good. And when we have quality guests like Marcos and Kyle Odegaard and Brett Coleman and Paul Bucher, et cetera, it's really been fun and to get their perspective. So keep up the good support. We really appreciate it. And until next time, may the red rain of Super Bowl confetti shower down on you into the red, red sea. Red rain.